Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Busy week, we know, when it comes to the Treasury trade this week. Also very busy when it comes to earnings. About 180, I think, S&P 500 companies. John said representing around 30%, but I think it's more than 40% of the index's market cap. But we have the expert who's going to tell us.
I'm not going to argue with either of you. How's that?
All right, so let's get to it, because some of who are reporting, we know, are among the Magnificent Seven names, some of the big mega cap tech companies.
Yeah, we're talking about Alphabet, Meta, Microsoft, and Tesla. For more, let's bring in Bloomberg Intelligence's Director of Equity Strategy and Chief Equity Strategist, Gina Martin Adams, who's here in our studio. Gina, you and the team have a note out that talks about, so far, it's early, but so far the earnings season is giving us a pretty good backdrop for stocks. Bring us up to speed here.
Yeah, so I think it's been an interesting earnings season so far, because we've had some really big charges from healthcare companies, Bristol Myers Squibb and now Gilead, who have both taken down estimates for the S&P 500.
I thought that was so interesting, that one or
just
two names.
Just those tiny, just those two companies, which really kind of escape our notice because we're so captivated by tech, have actually made the bigger impact on earnings. Nonetheless, when you exclude those two charges, you're tracking about 5% earnings growth for the S&P 500, including analyst estimates for what's to come. That's a bit better than the analysts were forecasting at the start of the season, which was just under 4% growth. So better than expected, but all the big companies have yet to report. We've got 37% of the market cap reporting this week, including the biggest names, Microsoft, Alphabet, and Meta. TMT is really where all the growth is expected to come from, so I'm a little old school. TMT is no longer the way we describe it. It's tech and communications, but those two sectors are TMT.
Okay. That's news to me.
For those of us that have lived, you know, through the 90s and beyond.
We can still call it telecom.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah.
The 90s
exactly.
were good.
Nonetheless, those groups are basically driving all of the growth on the index this quarter, so that's where all of the optimism lies and certainly where most of the risk lies as well.
Well, it's interesting. And, you know, when we get to things like margins and different ways of kind of looking at the quarter, I mean, is there anything of note that you're focusing on that front?
Yeah. So margins are incredibly important because margins are where all of the analyst optimism is going forward. There's a couple of ways that earnings can beat. You can see top line beats, which certainly would be very, very welcome. Analysts are not anticipating a whole lot of top line growth to emerge this year. Or you can see margins beat expectations, where analysts are already anticipating margin improvement coming through the year. So I think that there's a bigger risk in margins than there is in top line growth, just for this reason, given expectations that are implied by the market as well as by analyst forecasts. Margins so far are coming in pretty strongly. We see the vast majority of companies beating on net income margins. Operating margin is still a 50-50. Where there is still a decent amount of operating risk, but net income margins companies are beating so far. So it's something we'll watch, especially with respect to tech.
Why do you think we've seen a steeper sell-off for misses so far this quarter? I know expectations are certainly high and this is earnings driven, but why is this quarter they're particularly sensitive?
It's mostly, I think it's a function of we're early yet more than anything else. So I don't want to draw too much into that, but we have seen companies respond pretty negatively to misses. I think it's a couple of reasons. The first is financials didn't start us off on a great foot. Even though companies generally beat expectations in financials, there's a lot of nervousness about what's going on in that space.
It felt that way as we went through
it. And it felt weak. Yeah. So that was a pretty weak start. Let's see where we go from here with respect to price performance following earnings. The other thing just to consider is some of this could be spurious, right? It could just be the market at large is selling off. And when the market at large is selling off, the misses appear to be enormous price responses, even when all it really is everybody's just selling risk.
I always feel like your tone
And I feel like your tone is a little bit more subdued or more cautious. Has it gotten that way?
Yeah, so not necessarily because of earnings. I think earnings are still a pretty solid backstop. Yeah. But at the end of the first quarter, when we run through all of the different models that we use to assess the equity market, the technicals actually were signaling a weak time to come, coming into the second quarter. Not necessarily that earnings are problematic,
yeah,
but things are more difficult now for a lot of reasons. Technicals, correlations inside the market were flagging a great degree of risk. Industry signals, all of our leading industry cues were turning over at the end of March.
All of them.
So, yeah, so wow. Semiconductors, home builders, transports, all the leading indicators of what you would anticipate were starting to turn over again. This doesn't mean a horrible climate, but this type of risk was flagged also to us back in July of last year when we were, you know, turning over into a 10% correction in stocks. So I want to sit, you know, be a little bit conscious of this. The technicals are quite weak. We started off on weak footing. That said, the economic strengths and the earnings strengths have only improved over the last 6 to 9 months. So there should be some offset there, but it does imply a choppier climate for Q2.
But what has come at the same time, and perhaps the reason, is the Fed chair actually talking last week about dialing back and resetting rate expectations. And we certainly saw some selling last week. And even this quarter on the S&P 500, we're down 4.2%.
Right.
Today's recovery, quote unquote recovery, notwithstanding. But I'm wondering how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, I view what happened at the Fed as an amplifier of existing trends, not the spark, right? We already saw markets turning over in anticipation of some greater weakness emerging over the second quarter. We saw that with the end of first quarter surge into a new high, and then we started seeing a turnover. So while the Fed speech last week was important, it merely amplifies what was already happening in the equity market. And I think if you read through to the stocks and sectors that performed poorly last week, I think what's really happening in the market is a lot of fear with respect to can tech continue to hold up amidst this environment of rotation, which really started to go all the way back at the beginning of March. We started noting rotation emerging in the equity market, this leadership transition. If tech's not the leader, who is the new leader? That creates a little moment of anxiety for the equity market at the very least, and may certainly stall the advance.
So the S&P back above 5,000 today. Last week was what? The worst week in over a year. S&P down about 5.5% from the March 28th peak to this past Friday. NDX, NASDAQ 100, down about 7% between that March 22nd high and last Friday. That is some of the nervousness we're starting to see.
Yep.
Could it get worse? Are you expecting more downside on these indexes?
Look, I think if the tech companies cannot satisfy expectations and keep raising forecasts going into the rest of the year, yes, it could absolutely get worse because tech has been such a big part of the market's optimism so far this year. Now, one thing is happening in the first quarter that I think is pretty notable and maybe is also behind this recent rotation in the market, and that is, this is peak earnings growth for tech. It is peak quarter. Between last quarter and this quarter, we're peaking. And we will have to see some earnings deceleration, at least according to the analyst consensus. Will the tech companies tell us it's not decelerating or not? Could be a key question over the course of the next few weeks.
A lot to keep us busy. All right, Gina, thank you so much. Gina Martin Adams, Chief Equity Strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence, here in studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right, everybody. Well, last week, you might remember the IMF edging up global growth. Meantime, the Atlanta Fed GDP Now model estimate for real GDP growth in the U.S. in the first quarter of 2024 is 2.9%. That was on April 16th. It's up from 2.8% before that. We're going to get another update from the Atlanta Fed on Wednesday. So we have seen the numbers. We've talked about this. They've been ratcheting them up higher.
Meantime, on this Earth Day, Bloomberg's Mark Gongloff reminds us that the only thing climate change is cooling is growth. Mark is Bloomberg opinion editor and columnist who covers climate change. He joins us this afternoon from New Jersey. Mark, the climate has gotten hotter. It continues to get hotter. But we know this. We knew that. What was surprising to me about the study that you cited is that it's going to actually make global income 19% lower by 2049. How do we get there? First of all, that's also there. And first of all, that's also bad news. I should that, know.
Yes, global income lower by 19% is definitely bad news. That amounts to about $38 trillion a year by 2049. Obviously, you're ramping up to that point, so you're losing trillions and trillions of dollars, and that is coming from just heat, for the most part, extreme heat, variability in temperatures too, and variability in water. So that affects, heat affects human health and productivity. Our brains don't work as well. We're not as productive when we're really hot. And the variability in water gives you huge droughts, as we're seeing already in Africa, and also gives you terrible flooding, which we're also seeing in many other parts of the developing world this week. So all of these things affect economic growth, productivity, agriculture, industry, all of that, shaving up to 19% off of global income, which is not the same as GDP, but it's just about the same. It's similar by 2049.
Yeah, it's going to impact how people, you know, around the globe, whether or not they've got money to spend, right? Which is certainly creates velocity, economic velocity and growth within the economy. Having said that, this study, as you note, Mark, in your piece, is that it's a little bit more, I mean, the cost is more than past research and studies have shown. What's the difference? Why are they coming out with this or finding this finding versus maybe some more subdued findings of the past?
Yeah, in fact, it's a lot more. There was a study, a famous study about 5 years ago suggested it would be more like 20% off of global GDP by 2100. This study says if we don't start cooling the planet down, or if we don't stop making the problem worse, we could have a 60% hit to global income by 2100. So you're talking magnitudes worse. They say that they have new models that they're looking at that incorporate the fact that some of these impacts on economics last forever. If you have a generation of kids who don't learn as much and don't have as much economic opportunity, that affects future generations. And so they have all these different variables they're plugging into their model, and they're spitting out these huge numbers. You could argue with the numbers, and some climate scientists have kind of taken some issue with a few of the numbers here and there. There are two important messages to me that come out of it, no matter how you slice the numbers, which are also very difficult to forecast, of course. One is that we are going to lose a lot more by not doing anything about climate change than we are going to lose by doing something about it. So BNEF, Bloomberg NEF, suggests it could cost $200 trillion by the middle of this century to mitigate climate change. $200 trillion is kind of a lot of money, but it's you spend that in about 6 years if you're losing $38 trillion a year. So it's an investment to avoid many, many more trillions of losses. And the second key thing is that much of this economic impact is landing on the people who deserve it the least. And so developing Africa, South Asia, South America, these places are going to see GDP hits of maybe 30 to 33% by mid-century. Again, according to this study, but again, this is consistent with what we know, that
right,
these impacts fall most heavily on places that probably deserve it the least.
Explain, because there's something you go into in the story about this isn't degrowth. And I don't know that it's a term that I feel like I've been using much when it comes to climate change, which is why we always love reading your columns. But you note that what fossil fuels are doing to the world isn't quite degrowth. So degrowth is what, when you kind of slow down output to reduce the impact on environment. This isn't what you're talking about.
No, not exactly. At first blush, it kind of seems like that.
Yeah.
And so there are climate activists who say, you know, we need to stop growing the economy so much. And so that would involve cutting growth. And I guess an example of this could be when COVID hit in 2020, you saw growth just fall off the table. And all of a sudden, nature was healing, and emissions weren't as bad. And people said, hey, if we just did this all the time, we'd save the planet. Well, the problem is you can't really do that all the time, because not having any economic growth, it creates its own problems, especially, again, for developing countries who haven't had the chance to develop and don't have the standards of living that we do. So what this is doing is not that. Even with climate change, the scientists are saying the economy will keep growing. It will just be stunted, sort of the way, you know, my mom used to tell me if I smoked cigarettes, my growth would be stunted. Yeah. It would stunt our growth. We would still grow, but it would be stunted. And over time, it would get much worse, which is the other key message to come out of this, which is that there is still time to avoid far worse outcomes.
I wonder, Mark, how a message like this resonates in your opinion, because Carol and I talk about this all the time. Walking into work when the skies are full of smoke from wildfires, you know, thousands of miles away, that is there's something visceral about that. You know, your basement becoming unusable because three or four times a year the weather is so extreme that it floods. You know, there's something that really hits you about that. But I'm wondering if this type of story, this type of data, hits people the way that those actual other things do.
It's really difficult because you're talking about future generations, and we seem to have a real hard time thinking about, well, you know, my grandchildren are going to suffer from this. And then also we have a really hard time putting numbers like $38 trillion a year into context. It's like, okay, $38 trillion a year, or you read the headlines about, well, all the Arctic ice is melting and the oceans are hotter than they've ever been. I mean, some of this stuff can be so gloomy that you just say, all right, well, we're doomed anyway. I might as well eat a cheeseburger and roll coal out in the parking lot. But it really is true that we still can make a difference, that we're not doomed by any stretch yet. And I think sometimes numbers like this, we are already suffering hits to our pocketbook right now. We talk about $38 trillion by 2050. People say, I don't even know what that means. I don't care. But people are losing money in Florida as we speak and in California because they can't get their homes insured. And the next wildfire season, the next hurricane season, the next floods that come, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be surprised to find that they're underinsured. And so they're going to take a huge financial and economic hit. So these economic hits are happening right now. And I think maybe that's a way to help contextualize it for people to make it real, like wildfire smoke.
Mark, to that point, there's another story on the Bloomberg, and it talks about the economic impact of climate change, specifically on global tourism, broken down by some of the top countries that rely on tourism for growth. And we have a great chart for those who are watching on YouTube and our Bloomberg Originals. But the whole idea is, and in this story, it says, by the end of the century, residents of northern countries will generally see sunny, spring-like balm appear, earlier in the winter. Conversely, those in the south, including equatorial regions and extending into southern Europe and the U.S., will, for the most part, enjoy fewer days of temperate weather year-round. I mean, this is something we talk about. Tourism is so important to so many different either cities or countries. Like, this is, again, another economic impact. Just got, forgive me, about 25 seconds. I mean, this plays to what you were talking about.
For sure. And even in those places, even in the places that will bear less of the brunt, there still is an impact. There's an economic impact. And in some of those countries you're talking about where there will be sunnier days, but maybe your skiing industry doesn't get as much snow, and so you lose a lot of tourism that way. And then you have climate refugees leaving the places that are hit a lot to try to go to the nicer places, and then you have a whole political issue.
Yeah, changing outdoor days, though, like changing. Interesting, tough, but as you always say, maybe not too late. That always gives me hope. Mark Gungloff, thank you so much. Editor at Bloomberg Opinion, joining us there in New York City. Check out his column. You can find it on the Bloomberg, at Bloomberg.com/opinion.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Today is Earth Day. And an important thing to think about is where on Earth all of our food comes from.
Yeah. And when it comes to farming in the U.S., well, farms are becoming fewer and farther between. The number of farms in the U.S. falling by more than 140,000 between 2017 and 2022. And the number of farm acres fell by 20 million over that same period of time. This is according to USDA data cited by the American Farm Bureau Federation. That's an advocacy group that represents farmers and ranchers, but generally on the decline.
Well, yeah, and the group argues, Carol, that there are too many challenges that just make it unsustainable for family farms to stay in business these days. That's where Elmer Mayer comes in. He's the co-founder and CEO of Neatleaf. It's working on technology that uses sensors, AI, and robotics to give farmers a granular view of their cultivation environment. The idea is that increasing crop yields and reducing costs, of course, helps with the growing environment. Elmer joins us from Santa Cruz, California. Good to have you back on the program, Elmer. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah,
I'm excited to be back.
Yeah, thanks for joining us again. Give us an update on where exactly you are with this spider technology and explain once again for our audience exactly how it helps farmers.
Yeah, happy to do so. So it's basically a football stadium camera for greenhouses or indoor growing environments. It's like a cable-based system, which like a football stadium camera basically moves around the canopy and floats above the crop and monitors the crop. It collects a lot of different data like temperature, humidity, CO2. It takes images to understand what's going on with each plant and analyzes it. So it's basically alleviates that burden for cultivators to walk the crop every day and check out every plant, which is tedious and like not scalable.
Is it possible in your mind ever to use this in fields outside and outside of greenhouses?
Oh, definitely. The way how we look at it is that Neatleaf is based on two pillars. One is the automation, the data collection, like the robotic side of things, where we developed the Neatleaf Spider to harvest the data. But then the other part is all the data analytics, like the processing of the data, the AI, which picks up on plant health, on pests, on crop properties. And that's agnostic to where the data comes from. So we could easily either mount four pillars outside of a vineyard and have a spider collect the data, or mount the same sensor box onto a drone and collect the data in an open field.
Talk to us a little bit about all of the data that you have been collecting, the quantity and kind of the diversity of that data that helps you help your clients.
Right. So the way how we looked at it originally was like we tried to understand how cultivators operate their environment, their fields, like their greenhouses. And they heavily rely on the visual feed. They obviously monitor the environmentals. They try to understand what's going on in the soil and the substrate. But then they really rely on looking at the plant, assessing what's going on, reading that language of the plants, and like doing that by like moving around the plant, walking the greenhouse, etc. And that was really what inspired us to create like a system which is flexible, low cost, easy to install, but at the same time provides all this information which is necessary to assess what's going on in the field. And so having image data, collecting like the assessing what's like taking in, like assessing what how the plants look like, what the issues might be, is just a new domain, a new dimension which we can offer to the cultivators. We count every yellow leaf, for example. We count every necrotic leaf, every folded leaf. We detect pests. We count every flower, flower size, how it evolves throughout the growth cycle. So now all of a sudden, you have a direct feedback loop to whatever you do in the field, to whatever happens. And you can say like, oh, my crop has 10% more yellowing today. It has 5% less folding. And compare crops across different growth cycles. That's unique.
It's kind of like the ultimate drone or spy camera, to be quite fair. And it reminds me of if you've ever gone to a sports game, or I think about when we're in the US Open covering it, tennis, and it's that camera that comes down and zooms and it's on these cables and it catches people you know, that are watching in the stands. So it's really kind of interesting in terms of the technology. And those who are watching us right now on YouTube and streaming on Originals can see it. Having said that, you guys have been up and running for about, I believe, 4 years or so now. Give us an idea of what the impact, if this is going to be helpful in terms of yield and growing and productivity and efficiency. I mean, tell us what the results have been from some of either the studies that you guys have done or some of the customers that you're working with.
Yeah, it has been an amazing journey so far. Where we started about 4 years ago, it took us like half a year, 9 months to come up with the idea of the spider, and then we executed on that idea. We quickly installed first prototypes and then iterated, improved, ensured that it works reliably, collects the data which we need. And we have been running these systems now for over 2 years in the field. And last summer, we then decided to ramp up production to really like accelerate and like produce more and more of the systems, because we realized that the customers really love it and there's interest. And since the beginning of the year, we have tripled installations, and we have a backlog of orders now until June, which is very exciting. But it really seems like it's a new concept of what you get from in terms of data from the field. But once customers see that in with their own field, it's just a very sticky product. They quickly understand the value and the power of this, and they want more.
How do you scale this? I've a hard time imagining the sales force that's required to go out and sell this product across the US and across the world to farms. It's not an easy thing.
And I'm curious how much it costs, because I'm thinking about smaller independent farmers, which are increasingly, whether it's organic or regenerative farming, which we've been doing a lot on in the last couple of weeks, you know, whether or not it's affordable.
Right. So the scaling itself right now, it's a lot about like going to trade shows, presenting the system, talking to potential customers, and the word of mouth by customers themselves, where we get a lot of incoming demand. Obviously, like installing the systems right now, it's our team which still goes to the different places, install the first system, but it's really designed in a way where the customers can install it by themselves. Most of them have like facility team if they are bigger, but even like, you know, all the cultivators are in general very handy, and they have to fix a lot of the issues around their farm anyway. So we try to design it in a way which makes it very like easy to install, so that we can just ship them a box, they install the system, and that removes all that overhead of installation cost, etc. Cost wise, it's very interesting. We try to alleviate that initial hurdle to kind of say like everyone can just try it out, you know, so you can rent the hardware for like $300 a month. You basically rent the hardware as long as you want. At the point where you want to commit to it, you just purchase it. It's a couple of $1,000s to purchase the hardware, and then you get a discount. So it's really worthwhile, basically, that investment. But we didn't want to have anyone to like really, you know, think long about before trying it out, because it's really this game changer when you see your own data gathered by the device.
One thing I'm thinking, for it to be kind of a game changer on the industry, perhaps in terms of methods, is the industrial farmers getting involved? Are any of them interested? Are they biting and signing up for the systems?
Definitely. They love it, especially the ones which have multiple facilities across different states or countries. They always struggle that they have, you know, their experts, which they then have to send around, they fly around, visit each facility and assess what's going on. With our system, they can provide way better feedback remotely. They can guide the teams on the ground. They can compare data across different facilities, which obviously allows them to like standardize it more and become more consistent. So we see a lot of very large excitement from exactly bigger industrial cultivators.
Really appreciate you joining us this afternoon with an update, Elmer. Thanks so much, Elmer Mayer. He's the co-founder and CEO of NetLeaf, the company using technology, sensors, AI, robotics to give farmers a granular view of their crops.
I think about it like either some of the vineyards, right? We were just talking on Friday and just doing the regenerative farming, but having that capability to kind of look around and see where there's problems in terms of leaves or, you know, pick up on problems
pests.
Or pests would be kind of cool. I don't know. It's kind of interesting, right, how they're doing it.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
He drives me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
4%. NVIDIA at 4% right now as we speak.
Wow.
Yeah.
All because of SoftBank?
Yeah, maybe. I think so.
What's going on there?
Yeah. It's actually one of my gainers. Courtesy of you, because I was actually like, I put it
it's
on my list.
Gainer.
Because
it's
like an analyst making some comments too about buying maybe the pullback, but SoftBank making a big investment. That's like $1 billion.
Yeah, and they're buying NVIDIA chips to power that Gen AI.
Yeah,
pretty cool.
That's pretty.
That's pretty cool. That's interesting.
That'll get a stock moving. Meta's up about looks like about 0.9%. Let me just pull it up. Make sure I got the current trade. It's up about 0.5%. It was up more than 2% earlier in the session. Apple, it's a little bit higher today, up about 0.8%. Netflix, yeah, just a tinge higher in today's session. Amazon, it is up. Just a quick check here, up about 1.4% here. So we're seeing some of those names that have often been, you know, so much of the momentum behind the overall equity trading gains in the S&P 500. Moving to the upside today.
Okay, well, let's get an idea of what our next guest has to say about all this. Dave Donabedian is Chief Investment Officer at CIBC Private Wealth Management. Dave, good to have you on the program. You argue that the recent pullback in stocks that we saw today, notwithstanding, could turn into a full-blown correction. What's your thinking there?
Sure. Good to be with you. Well, I would say we're not all that far from her. We've had a nice rally today, but before that, we had a 5-6% pullback. And if you're going to call 10% a correction, it's not that far away. It's a seasonally challenging time for equities as you roll into April and May. And you've got to remember that we entered the month of April with a highly valued market, 21.5 times, PE multiple on the S&P, a sky high positive sentiment. And it was just sort of ripe for some disappointment. And, the macro environment that was so rosy in terms of the consensus, where inflation was going to come down, the economy is going to keep chugging along, double digit earnings growth, and of course, very aggressive rate cuts from the Fed, obviously looks a little different today. The growth story, I think, is going to come through, but the inflation numbers have been kind of sticky on the way down, and obviously there's been a radical downgrade in terms of expectations of how much help and when we're going to get it from the Federal Reserve. So it's just a somewhat more challenging macro environment in the context of a somewhat highly valued market, and it wouldn't take that much to get to correction territory. But the important point is it's a correction within a bull market. It's a normal part of the process. It's just the uncomfortable part.
Well, it's interesting too. The S&P, yeah, as you said, it's down about 5.5% from the March 28th peak to this past Friday. The NASDAQ 100 down about 7% between the March 22nd high and last Friday. So we definitely have seen, a different trend line over the last 3 weeks or so. Having said that, do you, on those pullbacks, Dave, say to your clients, this is an opportunity to actually get a name that's now a little bit cheaper than it was a few weeks ago?
For some names, yes. I wouldn't say that about the overall market, but certainly you're always looking at these pullbacks, or even they become corrections, as opportunities to be able to buy stocks at the price you want to buy it at. There haven't been that many of those in this after this market rise. So sure, on a selective basis, there are stocks today that are more attractive than they were at the beginning of the month.
Why would you why say selective, Dave? Why would you say the overall market is not even is not a good deal right now?
Well, I go back to valuation and the fact that it's kind of great expectations were built into those valuations, and we still have a process here where I think the market has to adjust to a somewhat less hospitable macro backdrop.
So I am curious, here's an interesting week, right? It's said to be the most important. We have the most names reporting when it comes to first quarter earnings this week. So we're going to get from a lot of big, well-known companies, including Alphabet. We're going to hear from Meta. We're going to hear from Tesla after the close tomorrow. So I do,
do you have a kind of thought about the big tech community and those names that have been so responsible for momentum? Do you think it's time to see them kind of, you know, continue to decline a little bit, maybe even more from where they've been? I don't know. I'm just curious if you have some thoughts on that, since our focus is so much on those names this week, Dave.
And you hit on the key issue. It's the earnings and the guidance that goes along with those earnings. I think the challenge for the you know, mega cap tech names is that the pattern of their earnings expectations being greatly exceeded and management guidance exceeding expectations, that the bar is pretty high, I think, to get big up moves off of earnings. They'll have to be, you know, I think, substantial beats with very, you know, positive forward guidance to really give these stocks a major lift from here. But, you know, one of the interesting things that is developing this year is one of the things we were looking for to confirm that this is, in fact, a bull market, mm-hmm. you know, from a sort of a longer-term context, is the fact that the market this year has not been wholly dependent on this handful of stocks. If you look at performance mm-hmm. year-to-date, actually tech is a middling performer as a sector, and you know, the leaders of communications is one of the leaders, because mostly because of Meta and Google. But the other leaders are energy, financials, and industrials. So we have seen a broadening out of market participation this year. And that's, I think, a really positive development. We're not just dependent on a handful of stocks to drive the index.
Okay, so give us an idea of what could derail your thesis this year. Because I know you mentioned in your note geopolitics, and it's not front and center today, but it's certainly in the back of a lot of investors' mind, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you.
Sure. I mean, geopolitics is always out there as a source of volatility in the markets, and there are more issues than normal today. So any given day, something could happen to jolt the market. There's no question about that. But we've gone back and looked at what happens in these geopolitical episodes, even when they go bad. And the market is extremely resilient, and you can't predict these geopolitical outcomes. So the focus continues to be on economic growth, inflation, monetary policy, currencies, and valuations. If you stick to those things, you'll be able to ride out the geopolitical crises.
All right, Dave, going to leave it on that note. Listen, thank you so much. Dave Donabedian, he's Chief Investment Officer over at CIBC Private Wealth Management, joining us from Baltimore.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.